trade is also subject to market manipulation, and we have seen that in multiple ways: withholding of supply, flooding markets, depressing prices, and that's had the effect of keeping some suppliers out of the market.
The AIG Global Trade Series 2024 is a series of podcasts brought to you by AIG in partnership with some of the world's leading centres of expertise on global trade. Visit www.aig.com/GTS. The series moderator is Rem Korteweg of the Klingendahl Institute.
Hello and welcome to the AIG Global Trade Series 2024. This is your host, Rem Korteweg, and today we are discussing critical resource policies in Southeast Asia and the trade in strategic minerals. So this is our 2024 season finale, and it is a great pleasure to be recording this conversation from Jakarta on the sidelines of the ERIA conference on trade and resources in Southeast Asia, critical materials, semiconductors, and industrial policy. Now, decarbonization, as well as the digital transition, have led to an increased demand for a number of specialty metals. Think of nickel and lithium for electric vehicles or rare earths for advanced microelectronics. And access to these metals is deemed increasingly critical for advanced economies. But the production of many of these metals is concentrated in a handful of places, including here in the region. And as geopolitical tensions rise, it has also led to growing concerns about security of supply. And there is increased attention, of course, also to the environmental footprint of the digital and green economy. At the same time, the extraction of these minerals presents an opportunity for countries in the region to attract investment and integrate deeper into the global economy. Now, earlier this year, we discussed what this means for the EU and the US, the industrial policies they are pursuing and the implications for trade. This time around, we want to focus on producer countries. So in this podcast, we want to make sense of Indonesian, Australian, and regional approaches to critical materials. I hope we can explore the role that these countries play in the global supply chain for critical metals and how these countries are responding to economic and geopolitical and sustainability pressures. And I'm particularly curious how countries in the region are dealing with the growing pressures towards fragmentation that we see elsewhere in the global supply chain of advanced technologies. Now, to help make sense of this, I'm joined by two fantastic experts in the field. Firstly, from Perth, I'm happy to welcome Professor Ian Satchwell. Ian is adjunct professor at the Sustainable Minerals Institute at the University of Queensland. Ian brings a wealth of experience in the mining sector and is, amongst others, the author of a recent report entitled Reclaiming Leadership, Australia and the Global Critical Minerals Race. And from Jakarta, I'm joined by Dr. Aloysius Joko Purwanto, who is energy economist at ERIA. And ERIA is, of course, the Economic Research Institute for ASEAN and East Asia. Joko works on, amongst others, electric vehicles and the battery supply chain. Great to have both of you here today. So let's get started. Ian, how would you describe the current state of trade in critical metals?
Well, as you said, Rem, in the introduction, trade and sources of critical metals, both mined and processed, are still too concentrated. Trade is also subject to market manipulation, and we have seen that in multiple ways: withholding of supply, flooding markets, depressing prices, and that's had the effect of keeping some suppliers out of the market or driving suppliers, for example, Australian nickel, out of the market. So it's a difficult market. It's a market that's in transition. It's a market that both current and aspiring supplier nations and consumer nations, industrialized nations like nations in the EU and the US, are seeking to have more predictable and regularized. But that's a work in progress.
Right. And when you say that the market is in transition, what particularly are you thinking of?
Well, like-minded nations have been very concerned about concentration of supply. Obviously, China and its domination of global critical minerals markets comes up quickly, but it's not all about China. There are risks involved in over-concentration of mining supply, say, of cobalt from the Democratic Republic of Congo, or lithium and Australia dominating mining supply, but China dominating processing of lithium. So there are multiple risks, and with global conflicts, as we're seeing, there's supply chain risks as well. Shipping, for example, being diverted around the Cape of Good Hope because it's been too risky to go through the Red Sea. So there's also sustainability risks and activists in communities who are upset by mining, and we've seen in several places in the world shutting down mines through their protest actions. So there are multiple risks. But the key issues that consumer nations, plus some producer nations, are dealing with, the risks of coming from concentration of supply and market manipulation.
Yeah, great. Thanks. And Joko, I mean, you're based here in Jakarta. Indonesia is, of course, a major producer of nickel, and there seems to be a lot of interest in Indonesia's nickel sector from many consumer countries. How would you describe the main dynamics shaping... Let's start first the nickel sector. What do you see what the Indonesian government is dealing with?
Thank you, Rem. So yeah, we have been like witnessing this kind of movement made by Indonesian government to downstream nickel production from the last 10 years at least, with the two times of banning nickel ore export to be able to concentrate or focus more on the refining and processing the nickel ore towards much more ready material to be built, not only for steel industry, but now, and it's growing up a trend, to be made as an electric vehicle battery. Then we look at this now that the government is really concentrating on that, first stepping or receiving a lot of investor coming from China, but not only to China, but recently we also learned that some Indian, also Japanese, will come to help with the processing and refining and making the commodities that are ready to be made to EV batteries. I guess like Indonesian government, what they intend to do is to make Indonesia as the battery production hub, battery supply hub. But beyond that also, they would like to build Indonesia as the electric vehicles and its industries hub and ecosystem altogether. I mean, Indonesia would like to be a kind of regional leader in this kind of industry. Of course, we see that Thailand has been developing its automotive sector, but Indonesia is much more have its advantage and on having nickel and on its reserve. And I think the government knows how to deal with that and to build the EV industry sector in Indonesia.
But do you think the Indonesian policy is going to be successful? Because there's been quite a bit of criticism that a lot of the downstreaming of Indonesia's nickel has actually drawn in primarily investment from China, which is now also being considered to be a bit of an obstacle to attracting more investment.
Yeah, that is the consequence of what happened in the last couple of years. I mean, now we are dealing with the things that most of the investor developing this nickel industry in Indonesia or battery industry about to start, they are coming from China. But the thing is that now if we need to put much more stricter regulation or standards, then we will be able to also welcome other countries' investors to come inside. I think Indonesia government is like learning by doing in this kind of sense. And I think they are aware of this kind of concern coming from outside especially. And I guess it will be interesting to see what will happen in the next couple of months or days, what will happen in Indonesia nickel industry.
Yeah, interesting. Ian?
Joko, Indonesia is the world's dominant nickel producer and has nickel output is growing very rapidly. But to get into automotive batteries, you also need lithium and graphite for anodes. So what's the Indonesian strategy for sourcing those, given that Indonesia doesn't have domestic deposits that we know about at home?
Yes, the first thing that we learned that Indonesia have been, they have setting up state-owned companies, Indonesia battery companies, IBC, also like four state-owned companies and also private sectors. And I guess this will be the starting point to produce batteries. Of course, we understand that Indonesia doesn't have lithium. But in the process, this company, as well as the backup strongly by the government, they are like securing the supply chain of having lithium. I need to learn more about where does this lithium will come. I mean, like, will it be from Australia or China? But we learn also that Indonesia and Australia has set up some cooperation that some part of the supply of lithium will be coming from Australia.
Very interesting. And both Australia and Indonesia are the object of admiration by both the US and the EU to strike more deeper critical materials deals with. At the same time, you see in Europe and the US a different approach to critical metals. What is that doing to the domestic debate regarding critical materials? Is that, I mean, Ian, is that factoring in what the Americans and the Europeans are planning to do or their ambitions?
I think it is, Rem, but the Australian government also has a policy, a fairly new policy called A Future Made in Australia. So like Indonesia, Australia would like to add value, and I put adding value in inverted commas because it's not always value adding if you get it wrong in terms of your policy and your industry investment. But Australia would like to add value to its critical materials before exporting them. That said, Australia's core business for many, many decades has been very efficient mining and transport of minerals, primary processing, but then exporting those minerals to the world. It will be interesting to see how the Future Made in Australia policy pans out. We are also seeing the start of some diversification of investment. Australia generates a lot of mining investment internally, but is also very reliant on foreign direct investment. A substantial proportion, but a declining proportion of that has come from China. I think we are going now to see investment from Europe and from the US as major consumer nations, and that will be good in terms of diversifying those supply chains. But also for Europe and the US, buying some good sustainability standards that are already in place. So the risk, it lowers risks with increasing concerns about sustainability of supply chains.
And we'll get to the sustainability question in a second. But Joko, you want to come in on this?
Yes, I just learned that also like an MOU between the European Union and Australia on the partnership on critical minerals have been just signed. Could you please explain a little bit about that?
Yes, so it took a while to conclude that agreement. Meantime, Australia had signed some 26 other multilateral and bilateral agreements on critical minerals supply chains. About half of those are actually also involve cooperating between Australia and other nations, particularly the US and EU and UK nations, around working with third countries to help build their minerals production, processing and sustainability capacity, or governance and sustainability capacities. So the EU agreement with Australia includes not just Australia producing minerals, processing them and selling them to the EU to reinforce the EU's supply chains, but also working together with the EU in countries in Asia, in Africa, to help build more diverse supply chains. Now, we haven't seen how that's going to work out. I might say that Australia also has multiple other agreements, in particular with the US and other nations in what's called the Mineral Security Partnership, to do similar things. And already the US, for example, is supporting Australian companies in other nations to supply US processing. So it's an interesting dynamic that's starting to develop. I should add, just before I finish on this, that only towards the end of September, the Mineral Security Partnership partners announced a new finance network where both export-import banks from Mineral Security Partnership members and development banks will work much more collaboratively around the world to help finance new critical minerals production.
Very interesting, because the financing is, of course, a crucial area. But just on these critical minerals agreements, does it cover the full range of minerals extraction that Australia is focusing on, which also contains like base metals, but or is it very specific on a number of specialty metals?
No, the agreements that I've seen, I've read most of them, aren't prescriptive about what are critical minerals, critical materials, or even strategic materials. There's different materials in different categories and they overlap. Talk about them generically. Each country or each region, like the EU, has a list or maybe two lists of critical and strategic type materials. And so in none of the agreements that I've seen is there a prescription of what they cover. Different nations have different materials for their own reasons on their critical materials list. So Japan, for example, has recently added uranium because it's really important to Japan's energy transition and they're restarting nuclear plants. So they've put uranium on their critical materials list. It's not on the US list. It's on the Canadian list as a major uranium supplier. Quite interesting. Perhaps uranium is not a particularly relevant element, but it just illustrates some differences between different nations.
Let me focus on Indonesia now again. Joko, what do people here in Jakarta make of the EU's and US critical materials policies? And how do you think it's impacting the way in which Indonesia is approaching its own resource base? In other words, do you think that the EU and the US are able to strike deals regarding more or better or more secure access to Indonesian nickel reserves, or what's holding it back?
Well, I guess the impacts of our relationship with the EU and US will put the pressure on the government to set a better or like a stricter standard of critical minerals mining and process and quarrying in Indonesia. I guess this is kind of quite balancing of what we have currently. I mean, like the majority of our market, I mean, like in this kind of industry based on Chinese investors. But now I think this kind of relationship with EU and US bring a much more balance in that sense that first it will push government or it should push government to put stricter but doable standards for the critical minerals processes and industry. And then the rationale behind that is that we are aware that at some point, our commodities that are produced in relation to these critical minerals will be much more competitive if they are produced based on the higher standard. And that is, I think, a very good point and reason to develop that standard. And secondly, is also the diversifying of sources of FDI, of investment. Because, of course, as Ian mentioned, that the in some critical mineral types, we don't have them. So that we need to have a secure supply chain and redundancy is a must in this case, so that we don't depend on one country, but several sources. And then also, we'd like to secure the markets for that.
There's a nice synergy, it seems to me, Joko, between Indonesia's desire to diversify inbound foreign direct investment in minerals and the desire of major consumer nations and regions like the US and the EU to diversify their sources. So it seems to me that's a nice synergy that Indonesia might be able to leverage. What do you think?
Yes, but one thing is that how about from the economic point of view? I mean, this should be kind of a thing that might be kind of barrier for the US or EU, because in general, the impression is that EU and US have higher standard in terms of ESG. And in that sense, the economic level of this kind of projects, of this kind of investment is more costly than what other countries like China offer to Indonesia. So basically, there will be a constraint on that from the economic point of view. But I think government like Indonesia need to learn that this is about something in the long term. So when we bring this perception in the long term, like environmental or climate or other sustainability aspects, then the higher cost can be kind of beneficial to develop. And this is not about only cash flow at the current state, but we should think about what will happen in the future.
Yeah, the problem, Rem, with that, and I agree totally with what Joko said, you know, Indonesia needs to transition, but right now markets have demonstrated an inability to add a premium for higher cost production. Markets, because markets behave like markets behave, tend to go for the lowest cost.
Yeah.
So the whole question is, how do we transition to higher cost mineral production in order to assure sustainable production? It has to happen, but right now it's not clear how it's going to.
Yeah, I absolutely see that. And that brings me to the following point, that from a European or even a US perspective, the ambition is to create a supply chain of critical materials that is, on the one hand, reliable, so secure, diversified, and sustainable. Now, let's unpack those three points. What is the benchmark? How do you know if your supply of critical materials is reliable and secure? What's the metric that you're then looking at?
You get supply when you expect it, and you don't get delays, and it's delivered at a certain quality, and you know it's going to turn up when you need it.
And then how do you know if your supply chains are sustainable?
That's a really good question. Right now, we actually don't have globally accepted benchmarks for minerals sustainability. That said, the International Council on Mining and Metals, which is the global NGO for the mining industry, is leading a process with the copper sector, with the gold sector, with the Canadian Minerals Association of Canada, which had pulled together quite some years ago a standard called Towards Sustainable Mining. Anyway, there's a need, and that's been recognised by the industry, to develop a common industry standard. Then comes the question, if that is then developed, how does that apply to end users? And I'm aware of a couple of other standards that end user industries are more involved in. And then how do we assure, I was going to use the word enforce, but that's the wrong word. Mm. How do we assure those standards and guarantee to end users and eventually the buyers of products like mobile telephones, for example, that the metals in their phones and the other minerals in their phones are produced sustainably? And so there needs to be some sort of assurance mechanism that probably governments need to at least oversee to assure end users and intermediate manufacturers that those supply chains are indeed sustainable. But first, we need those standards.
And absent those standards, it's happening on a bilateral or even unilateral basis. How is that taking place in Indonesia? I mean, the whole question of sustainable nickel extraction and processing.
Well, I think like countries in Southeast Asia, not only Indonesia, we are struggling to that kind of question. I mean, like Indonesia, what we had in the past with our crude palm oil export, so that we started at some point in time to develop Indonesian national standard of sustainability for those CPO products. I think for the nickel, Southeast Asian country, I mean, ASEAN should work on first like a regional standard. Regional standard means that it will keep all the critical mineral commodities related to be able to be traded or to be exchanged regionally in ASEAN under the same standard. And I guess this is not supposed to be as high as what we imagine will be produced like by European Union or by US or by Australia, but it should be like a doable but to some extent it puts some a better standard than nothing. I think as we see like in the data that I have been able to obtain from the ASEAN and trade, and it appears that within ASEAN country, the trade or like the export within ASEAN country of critical minerals have been increasing quite significantly since the last 5 to 7 years. And I guess that kind of regional standard will really facilitate this growth. And this will like shortcut the supply chain. If it will facilitate development of the supply chain of critical minerals in the region.
Actually, ASEAN has started in a small way on a journey towards sustainability standards. It was last November that ASEAN mining ministers, who only meet once every 2 years, signed off on a set of sustainability principles for minerals production. Now, it's mentioned in their communique from last November. There is a set of principles, but they haven't been publicised or explained, much less has a plan been made, no, on how to implement them and how to turn those principles into standards. So at least the journey has started. There's work to do.
So the more exposure, the better for those ASEAN principles, I would say. Joko, you also not just look at critical materials extraction and processing, but also more downstream, how this feeds into the automotive sector, particularly in an Indonesia's context where it wants to move up the value chain, start also producing electric vehicles perhaps at some point. How does this question of sustainability and the environmental footprint connect with broader ambitions in the automotive sector? And are there limits to, frankly, how many electric vehicles we need given the pressure that it puts on the environment?
Okay, thank you for the question, Rem. Yes, I think like what we can observe now is that in ASEAN, like Southeast Asia countries, the rate of vehicle or car ownership is quite low, I mean, compared to the advanced economies. And if you look at the big cities in Southeast Asia, then they are about at the same level of ownership. And now what happened is that governments in Southeast Asian countries, they are giving a lot of incentives for these EV industries to be developed, EV electric vehicles or electric cars to penetrate the market. And there is no scheme that we have to scrape the old vehicles, the dirty vehicles. There is nothing like this in this country. That means that this also raises a concern of how this kind of continuously growing car ownership rate in big cities will add to the kind of wasting of energies. I mean, even if it is like electric vehicles, at some point the congestion is not good. It will bring us to the less efficient energy use. And I guess like in some years from now, ASEAN countries need to think about putting this electric vehicle development, or starting from now, under the scheme of more sustainable mobility or more sustainable transport, where the component of shared should be included. And that means that we will use, for each of the vehicle, we will use or increase its kilometer instead of having more vehicles. Then people will share the same vehicles for the, longer mileage. But this kind of thing need to be seen and need to be planned, because the growth of automotive industry, like the growth of sales, cannot be eternally fast. And I think that will be the core of the transport sustainable mobility.
Sitting in Jakarta as we are, I have observed the increase in congestion even from when I was here a few years ago. So sooner or later, Jakarta is going to reach a practical limit in the number of vehicles that it can handle, correct?
Yes, indeed. I mean, like big cities, we have policies to increase the shares of the use of public transport, but this kind of policies of putting more electric cars or selling more electric cars is really contradictory to what we have now in big cities.
And what about circularity or recycling of these metals? Because we're all talking about basically very linear process, extraction, processing, and then downstreaming. But how are Australians and Indonesians thinking about the prospect of creating more circularity in critical resources?
I think Indonesia is ahead of Australia from what I have heard recently in terms of, for example, EV battery recycling. And that's an advantage of greater vehicle density, frankly. More vehicles make it easier to have more circularity and recycling and reuse of materials. In Australia, a very sparsely populated continent with a fairly low penetration so far of EVs for a range of reasons, it's going to be harder to have, and we're thinking, I'm thinking about the EV case, of course circularity goes beyond that, but it's going to be more difficult. That said, Australia has a very high penetration of solar PV generation, particularly on household rooftops. It's the highest penetration in the world.
The Netherlands comes second for some odd reason.
But, really? Yeah. Okay, well, Australia's a bit more sunny than the Netherlands when I last observed, but that's good. But the question then comes, what these solar PVs lose efficiency and then it tips off quite steeply. You know, they'll go for a good 15, maybe 20 years and then really practically you need to dispose of them. The big question for Australia is how we dispose of those, or rather, how do we recycle those, extract the minerals from them, do no harm in terms of waste, and then hopefully reuse a bunch of materials in new solar PV arrays that go back on roofs to replace those that have reached the end of their useful lives. It's not a question that's really been answered yet. There's lots of platitudes from politicians and others that would like to get into the business, but I think we're just at the start.
Right. Anything to add on that from an Indonesian perspective or an ASEAN perspective?
Yes, I also heard that that Indonesia is preparing some business plan to recycle or to reuse those battery waste. But the thing is that I think we need to have also like interesting scheme or mechanism on scrapping those vehicles. I mean, until now, we don't have that. I mean, there is no vehicle inspection regulation for passenger vehicles in Indonesia, or I haven't heard that, perhaps in Singapore, but not in other Southeast Asian countries, not like in Europe, where you have like a obligatory technical inspection, 5 years, 7 years, and so on. We don't have that. But I think while the business will be ready to take those waste batteries, we need to create kind of mechanism to incite people to scrap their vehicles and the industry to absorb that. This should give benefits from both users and also companies.
So let's bring it back to the question of trade in critical metals. And I'd like to push both of you to formulate sort of suggestions or policy prescriptions of steps that either individual countries or the region as a whole can take to make themselves more attractive as sustainable, diversified, and secure suppliers of critical metals. Are there things that, you know, Indonesia and Australia should be doing to take that spot in the global value chain for critical metals?
I think we have seen also like in Indonesia case or in Southeast Asian case, the data shown us that the FDI to ASEAN, for example, in critical minerals have been declining for more than 10 years. And the share of the FDI of critical minerals relative to the total FDI share is also declining. I guess one thing that Southeast Asian countries need to work on is creating certainty on regulations, such as the tax obligations and then regulation on setting business. I mean, this kind of business facilitation or certainty, like certitude of what to do, what are the next step, and then the guarantee that if we comply with all the regulation, then our business will be also put in a safe. That is missing from Southeast Asian countries, and that is one of the reasons why it is quite difficult to attract FDI. I think that one point, to develop or to work on political regulation or certainty.
Yes. Look, I would agree with that, Joko. And I'm seeing manufacturing in Southeast Asian countries expanding at a very rapid rate, in part because of diversification of supply away from China. And China is offshoring a bunch of manufacturing that previously was contained within China. So we've got manufacturing increasing rapidly, but we've got the production or investment in production of minerals to supply that manufacturing in Southeast Asia actually declining. That gap is widening and it needs to be closed. And the key to it, as you said, Joko, is foreign direct investment. And the key to that is having a more attractive investment climate. And as we have seen with a couple of European nickel cobalt investors, if you don't have the investment environment, particularly around sustainability, you can frighten them away. Yeah. So there's a lot of work to be done, as you say. I think there are a number of nations, consumer nations, but also the major mining nations like Canada and Australia who stand ready to assist, because it's very much in their interests as well as in their interests from an investment perspective, because their companies are global, to have countries in Southeast Asia lift its mineral output. I'll make one quick point. This is not a zero-sum game in that we're not dealing with just a flatlining demand. The International Energy Agency says for the energy transition alone, we need to more than double minerals output. Right now, the current mineral producers, Southeast Asian countries, Australia, Canada, countries in Latin America and Africa, are not producing nearly enough. And the big heavyweight producer nations like Canada and Australia cannot hope to produce enough lithium and other minerals to resource the global energy transition. So this is a great opportunity, and there's a necessity as well to grow output from Southeast Asia and other parts of the world. But there's a challenge around investment environment and also around the sustainability of mineral production, particularly given that in Southeast Asia, at least, the dense populations that might start to get a bit concerned about unsustainable mining practices.
That's terrific, Ian. Thanks so much. It also raises this question not only about what Indonesia or other countries in the region can do to make themselves more attractive for non-Chinese or diversified sources of FDI. It's also a question of, are there any steps that partners can take, for instance, in the shape of either trade agreements or plurilateral initiatives that would help move this file forward? I see you nodding, Ian.
So I mentioned earlier the Mineral Security Partnership Finance Network that got announced at the end of September, an excellent example of a joint initiative of the major consumer nations and regions, the major producers like Canada and Australia, and a few other nations getting together with their export-import banks, and I'm thinking also Korea, Japan, I mustn't forget them as major consumer nations, getting their export-import banks coordinating, collaborating much more closely, and also their development banks. Mm. These are the banks that go in and help finance projects in developing countries. There's also quite a bit being done increasingly by the US, Canada, and to an extent Australia, although it's tailed off from Australia, of mining governance-related development cooperation and building up, helping countries in Southeast Asia build their mining governance capacity and therefore better outcomes from a sustainability perspective and including better returns to host nations, regions, and communities.
So then, I mean, the final question is, where will we be 5 years from now? I mean, is this trade going to stay sort of what it is, or are we going to see real critical metals deals being struck? Will Southeast Asia in 5 years' time play a different role globally, you think, in terms of the supply of critical metals? Are you optimistic or pessimistic about where we are going and what role are governments going to be playing?
Yes. 5 years from now, I think many countries in Southeast Asia will be still kind of stretching or looking for a better position. But what will be determining is, I guess, like 10 years from now, perhaps the departing point from my perspective is the automotive sector. And we need to see what will happen in the next 10 years from now. Will it be like the domination of battery electric vehicles in Southeast Asian countries? Or will it be like a hybrid electric vehicle combined with biofuel, this kind of propulsion technology that will still be consuming fossil fuel oil, I mean gasoline and diesel? I think starting from that, then we will see what kind of situation in particular, looking at first in the automotive sector, the development of that industry, and then track back to the critical mineral industry. I think we need to see what will happen in the market of automotive. And if by 10 years from now, for example, like BEV, battery electric vehicle, will be dominating the shares or sales shares, then we will see that also like the power generation sector will need to follow, will need to catch up. That means that need to produce much more renewable-based electricity, meaning much more supply from critical minerals are needed to develop more solar PV, more wind, and this kind of power generation types. I think 10 years from now will be determining, but in the middle, maybe some milestone.
Yeah, but it's also, I mean, I would also argue that technological change has a role to play in this as well. I mean, we're all assuming that, for instance, nickel batteries are going to be the future, but we also see innovation taking place where, you know, sodium batteries are Indeed. Making some inroads.
Indeed. For example, like if we are now counting very much on the nickel, manganese and cobalt kind of composition of battery, but we need to take care also of the development of lithium, iron and phosphate, for example, which is growing up in the faster rate than the NMC. And then this will be really critical for Indonesia that concentrates in industry on nickel. I mean, this kind of thing need to be considered.
Now, that is a risk that there will be substitution, and it may indeed be driven by the costs of current technologies, but also by the ever-growing need for energy density in batteries in automotive applications. And it may be that as the R&D in a variety of places, and you mentioned India, Jocko, develops, as that R&D progresses, we may well see breakthroughs which will create a step change in energy density and help create a shift. Predicting that is a bit difficult, but answering your question, if I may answer it globally, you asked it around Southeast Asia, but I will talk globally, including Southeast Asia. I hope we see real progress and demonstrated progress in more diverse supply chains, demonstrated progress in making them as secure as we can, secure from manipulation, secure from major natural events. So that's about infrastructure resilience, for example, around key production centres. Then we also see real inroads into sustainability. But to do that, of course, we need sustainability standards, and then we need some assurance mechanisms so that everyone trusts those standards and we know that they are being complied with when a product is certified as being produced to these standards.
And that's a perfect note to end on, because unfortunately, this is all we have time for today. We've covered some of the challenges, some of the opportunities, but definitely the dynamics shaping the critical materials sector. It's been fascinating talking to both of you to cover not only the Indonesian angle in Australia, but also the broader region, as well as some of the global dynamics. Now, this has been the last episode for 2024. This year, we focused in our podcasts on changes in the global trading system and how that system could be gravitating towards more managed trade as governments, pushed by concerns about geopolitics, competitiveness, and the climate transition, increasingly try to play a role to shape or rather reshape supply chains. We unpacked this in podcasts on critical metals, the US and European approach to trade in electric vehicles, dynamics in the Americas, the EU-UK relationship, India's developing approach to trade, digital services, and US and British trade policy in an election year. Now, we know the trading system is in flux, not just in the area of critical metals. And together with our Global Trade Series network, we will continue to help you understand it. For now, thank you very much to Ian Satchwell and Jocko Purwanto for talking to me today. This has been terrific. Please check out our other conversations for the AIG Global Trade Series at www.aig.com/GTS or simply get them through your podcast app.
The AIG Global Trade Series 2024 is an international partnership between AIG, the Aspen Institute, Germany, CEPRI, the Brazilian Center for International Relations, Chatham House, CITD, the Center on Inclusive Trade and Development at Georgetown University Law Center, the Klingendahl Institute, Elcano Royal Institute, AREA, the Economic Research Institute for ASEAN and East Asia, ISPI, the Italian Institute for International Political Studies, the Jacques Delors Institute, Rieti, the Research Institute of Economy, Trade and Industry, and the St. Gallen Endowment for Prosperity Through Trade. To access articles and opinion pieces from partners in the Global Trade Series, and to listen to more episodes on global trade, visit www.aig.com/GTS or follow the AIG Global Trade Series wherever you get your podcasts. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views, policy, or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by the speakers in this podcast series is their opinion and is not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or group of individuals, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no warranty or representations as to the accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and AIG will not be liable for any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions in the information provided during this podcast series, or any damages, losses, liabilities, injuries resulting from or arising from the podcast, including your use of the podcast.